Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Authors Read, where we showcase authors, storytellers, and poets reading from their published work. Your host, Lillian Brummett, is the co-author of the popular book promotion guide, Purple Snowflake Marketing, How to Make Your Book Stand Out in the Crowd. Lillian is also the host of the Conscious Discussions talk radio show that airs three times a week. Visit www.brummett.ca for information about the world of writing and how to appear on this radio show. With your host, Lillian Brummett.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today at Authors Read. It's such a pleasure to have everyone from around the world joining us here on this radio show. Now, today, we have the honor of having Dave Richardson here with us. Now, he was born and raised in Southern California, which, of course, is in the United States, and he went to university, and then in 1960, he married his high school sweetheart, and then he joined the U.S. Air Force. Now, over the next 24 years as an Air Force helicopter fixed-wing pilot, he would be stationed at various places in the United States, and he served in Vietnam as well. Richardson's personal experiences during harrowing rescue missions and his perspective on unpopular war are shared in the pages of this exciting and insightful book that we're going to be hearing a portion of today. So Dave is going to be reading from his book, Vietnam Air Rescues, and you can find out more about Dave at www.vietnam-air-rescues.com. Again, that's vietnam-air-rescues.com. Dave, the show is all yours.
Thank you, and good morning. First rescue, over the river and through the woods. This rescue took place in November 1967. Embarking on a three-day alert trip up north, we took off early from home base, planning to arrive at Lima 36, our daytime site, at first light. As we were overflying the nighttime site, however, my wingman announced he had hydraulic problems. He stated he thought it was just the gauge and that the limited maintenance available on the ground should be able to repair it in a few minutes. I advised him my plan to continue on alone. He reminded me that we were not authorized to fly single ship over enemy terrain, but I reasoned that he could catch up with me shortly, and as there was a heavy bombing schedule laid on for the day, I wanted to be close to the action in case we were needed. Arriving at Lima 36 as dawn broke, I circled and buzzed the strip a few times. No one opened fire, so I figured it still belonged to us. I landed, and we began to refuel from the fuel barrels. Not long after that, we had finished refueling and were assembled in the hut. Then we received a mayday call that an F-4 had been hit over Hanoi. We immediately scrambled and headed on an intercept course. When the fighters caught up with me, they inquired where the other helicopter was. I told them, "Don't worry, he'll join us shortly." As we homed in on the aircraft's distress beacon, it became apparent that the pilot had headed west-northwest toward China, rather than southwest, away from China and toward Laos. This presented quite a problem. The United States was extremely worried at the time that the Chinese would find some excuse to intervene in Vietnam, just as they had in Korea. As a result, American aircraft were prohibited from flying near the Chinese border. Regardless, we continued to fly an intercept course toward the survivors. As we arrived in the vicinity of the Black River, which was the northern and western limit of air operations, we realized we would have to cross the river if we were to rescue the two pilots. The riverbank was heavily defended, so we climbed 10,000 feet and jinked and spiraled down as we crossed it. The flak was heavy, but all five aircraft, one helicopter, and four fighters managed to cross without incident. While we flew toward the area where the survivors were down, two of the fighters sped ahead to reconnoiter the scene, while the other two stayed behind to protect me. The lead fighter established voice contact with the pilot, who said he was about two-thirds of the way up a very steep ridge covered with racer grass. Because of the grass, he was not able to move. There was no contact with the backseater. As I entered the area, I spotted a steep ridge, which was clear of trees, but covered with tall grass. At the foot of the ridge was a small hamlet. I observed several military trucks parked there. Some soldiers were busy setting up what looked like an anti-aircraft gun, while others were attempting to cut a path up the ridge to the survivor. Due to rules of engagement restrictions, we were unable to open fire on them. I calculated we might have enough time to pick the pilot up before the ground troops could reach him. At my instruction, the survivor popped his smoke. Now I knew exactly where he was on that ridge. I began to ease the helicopter close to the ridge, hoping to be able to establish a hover over him. It was tricky work. There were strong cross currents of wind which bucked the helicopter around. What complicated matters was the necessity to hover with my rotor tips just a few feet from the steeply angled ridge in order to get over him. I went into my hover mode, which consisted of entrusting all aircraft gauges and radios except guard frequency to my co-pilot, and blocking out everything else as I concentrated on holding the helicopter absolutely still while the hoist was being lowered. It was vitally important that the helicopter not be allowed to move even as much a foot in any direction, or we would risk dragging the survivor through the sharp grass, or, worse, knock the rotor blades off against the ridge. Finally, the hoist reached the survivor, and he began to climb on the paddle seats. We had just begun lifting him off the ground when an enemy soldier rolled over the top of the ridge above me at a distance of about 75 to 100 feet. He aimed his AK-47 at us and began firing. Feeling, rather than hearing the bullets impacting the fuselage just below my sheet, I yelled to the guys on the back that we were taking fire and transmitted the same message to the fighters. In the meantime, the enemy soldiers' bullets had continued to rise and tore into the rotor blades. The aircraft began to buck and jump as the blades lost their tracking stability. At that time, we flew our helicopters unarmed. Our only weapons were our personal M-16s. My PJ leaned out the door past the flight mechanic, who was busy operating the hoist, and emptied his clip into the enemy soldier. Without a doubt, he saved my life. Our PJ was rather gung-ho and had loaded his M-16 with straight tracer rounds. I saw a bright tongue of flame spurt from the cabin door and rip the head off the soldier, whose body tumbled down the ridge below me. Due to the excessive vibration, I was barely able to hold the hover as we got the survivor on board. As soon as he was safely in the cabin, I pulled away from the ridge. The fighters, now freed of restrictions, were doing an enthusiastic job of obliterating the hamlet, along with the trucks and guns. The survivor called out he thought his backseater was nearby, but we had more pressing problems on our hands. The helicopter was vibrating. The vibration was so bad, I seriously thought we might lose one of the blades. It was difficult to hold it steady as I turned toward home. Two of the fighters accompanied me while the other two remained behind to complete their destructive work. As we were limping along, one of the fighters called out, "Don't look now. It appears you have a MiG at 6 o'clock and closing." They both went back to engage the jet while we pondered our next move. The classic defense of a helicopter against a fixed-wing fighter is to head straight for your opponent and then auto-rotate. The high sink rate of auto-rotation, coupled with the jet's rapid closure speed, should make him steepen his dive angle until he has to break it off. Then the helicopter can play tag among the ground clutter. That's a textbook theory at any rate. I had never heard of anyone actually trying it, and I wasn't about to be the first. Not with the control problems we were encountering. We could see the MiG as a faint speck in the sky. I slid over into a cloud bank, hoping he didn't have infrared missiles and would lose visual contact. We couldn't stay in the clouds for very long, however. I knew that the peaks of nearby mountains were poking up into those clouds, and I didn't want to smash into one of them. The helicopter was still bucking and shaking. I didn't want to perform any violent maneuvers, as I wasn't sure it would hold together. When I couldn't stand it anymore, we dropped out of the cloud layer and anxiously scanned the sky. My PJ shouted, "There! 10 o'clock!" I pulled back into another cloud, still praying the MiG was guns only and didn't have infrared or radar homing on board. When we exited a few minutes later, we couldn't see the MiG anywhere. Where had he gone? 5 o'clock high, shouted my flight mechanic. I plunged into yet a third cloud. This time, when we exited, the MiG was nowhere in sight. I can only assume he was low on fuel and had to head for home. We plodded along our way, shaking and bucking, and were joined by the two fighters who had stayed behind to strafe the enemy. Once again, we were approaching the Black River, this time from the north. There was no way I was going to attempt the 10,000-foot corkscrew maneuver we had done earlier. I was convinced the helicopter would fall apart if I did. Operating on my theory that the closer I am to the ground, the harder I am to see and hit, I flew at treetop level across the river while the fighters did their high-altitude bit. The gunners were so busy trying to hit them that we managed to roar over in safety before they could realign the guns. We began to notice a stiffening in the controls. Sure enough, a quick glance at the hydraulic gauge showed a fluctuating, decreasing pressure. We were losing hydraulic fluid. Some of that guy's bullets must have nicked a hydraulic line. This was a new and quite serious problem. The HH-3E is a large helicopter. The flight controls are hydraulically assisted, much like power steering in a car. It was impossible for the flight crew to control the helicopter if hydraulic power failed completely. I advised the fighters of our problem and that we might have to make an emergency landing. Looking around, I had no desire to set down in the vastness of the North Vietnamese jungle. I resolved to continue flying until the last possible moment. After a while, we heard the backup helicopter on the frequency. He'd gotten his bird fixed and was looking for us. He met up with us, flew alongside, and confirmed we had hydraulic fluid streaming out the bottom of the aircraft. My best estimate was that we were still about 30 minutes out of Lima 36. Our choice was to land there or crash into the rocks and jungle. There was simply no place else to go. At the same time, I was concerned about the backseater we had left behind. I hated to think an American was going to be lost when we had the ability to get him. Finally, I directed the other helicopter to take the fighters and go back to try for the other guy. He protested that I would be left all alone, but I pointed out if I didn't make the trip, my chance of survival in a crash landing was very slim. After a bit, he agreed to make a try at rescuing the backseater. Wonder of wonders, I made it to Lima 36. As I was attempting to set the helicopter down, I lost control and fell the last 10 feet or so, resulting in a huge bounce and one of my worst landings to date. But we were on the ground and safe. Praise God. I shut down the engines amid cheers from the crew. As we started to kill electrical power, we heard the other helicopter transmitting a mayday call. An anti-aircraft shell had severed his tail rotor shaft. He wasn't sure how long he could maintain level flight and wanted help. I was heartsick. We had just barely made it on the ground ourselves. Nevertheless, I wasn't about to abandon him. I told my crew I could fly the bird by myself. They could wait with our survivor until I got back, if I got back. They were a good crew and refused to remain behind. So I handed my M16 to the survivor and told him to sit inside our wooden hut with the gun aimed at the door. He was to shoot anybody who tried to enter that didn't speak English. His eyes got very wide. I told him if we weren't back in an hour, we weren't coming back. In that event, he was to wait until just before sunset before he dismantled and discarded the weapon. Then he should walk toward the fortress on the hill with his hands in the air shouting, "American! American!" Perhaps they would take him in. A replacement alert crew was due in 3 days, after all, and they could get him out. He didn't look too happy with the situation, but accepted the rifle. We got fired up and took off toward the other helicopter, which had a real problem. Unless they maintained 50 knots of forward airspeed, the helicopter would corkscrew, making any landing doubtful. We pulled alongside him, shaking and vibrating quite badly. Sure enough, his tail rotor was completely stopped. Both helicopters turned and headed back, eventually getting Lima 36 in sight. But now we had a different sort of problem. Whoever attempted to land first would most likely crash, thus denying the very short strip to the second helicopter. I was certain I would not be able to make another safe landing, but there was a chance for my wingman. I told him to come in at 60 knots, plop it on the ground at the start of the strip, shut everything down, and ride the brakes, hoping he could stop before going over the cliff at the far end. He did a great job getting his bird down in one piece. Now it was my turn. As we came in for the landing, I lost control about 10 or 20 feet in the air. The helicopter hit hard. The left gear partially collapsed, and the helicopter tipped it over 45 degrees on its left side, resting on the sponson. Apparently, my first hard landing had weakened it. In the process, I wrenched my knee quite severely, but otherwise, everyone was okay. So there we were, towards noon on our first day of a 3-day alert, one survivor, 8 crew members, and 2 broken helicopters. We took a look at the bullet damage. There were a few holes starting just below my seat on the right side. It was obvious the rising stream of shells had come in my open window, passing in front of both pilots and exited through my co-pilot's open window. I felt as though God must have been working overtime, protecting me from harm. There were also holes in the rotor blades. That was the source of our vibration. We radioed in our status and were advised to stand by. 3 helicopters were being dispatched. We felt like celebrating. We would get to go home early. A few hours later, 3 helicopters landed, the crews got out, and they and the survivor climbed on the third bird. "What about us?" we asked. "You have 2 more days of alert to serve before you come home," they replied. That was my first rescue of the Vietnam War.
Well, what a beautiful reading by Dave. That was very well done, Dave. If anyone would like to follow up and find out more information about him and his book, Vietnam Air Rescues, which is obviously has some breathtaking stories in there, you can find out more about that at vietnam-air. That's Vietnam-Air-Rescues.com, Vietnam-Air-Rescues.com. And, of course, you can see that I've placed that URL on the write-up for today's show, and you can see that there's a link for his book there as well. And if you'd like to find out more information about Dave and I and the work that we do, the three books that we have available, our blog, our newsletter, or anything else that you'd like to know about Dave and I, you can find that out at www.brummett.ca. That's B-R-U-M-M-E-T.ca. Until next time, take care, everyone.